Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Shift Extension Paramedic Podcast. I am your host, Nick, and joining me once again as my co-host is Sonny Whitfield. This is our first episode back from 2023. How's your Christmas, Sonny?
Back from 2022 and now back from 2023.
Sorry, I get my years mixed up.
Christmas here was awesome. We spent the day at the beach and doing what we do in the Southern Hemisphere when it's 35 degrees and Christmas.
Awesome. So this is kind of like our quasi season two of the podcast. This will be our 11th episode. We're going to start off 2023 with some case studies. And these case studies, they reflect a group of cases that we've been to in our own practice. And we've had a lot of learnings over the years. Like between Sonny and I, we started our training together many years ago. We've got almost 25 years between us. We've made a lot of mistakes in those years. We've learned a lot of lessons, and we want to share those learnings with our audience, hopefully helping you become more confident and capable paramedics. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to get some guests on this year as well. We've got some really exciting ideas and things to share with our audience as well. So lots of cool things coming up. But today we're going to start with a case study, and we'll just jump straight into it. You ready to go, Steve?
I'm pretty keen. I want to hear what this case is.
Awesome. So for all our paramedics out there who've been around a few years, this is going to sound like a pretty common case, but we're going to unpack it and hopefully generate some learnings. So we've got Sonny. You are called to a 75-year-old male. He's feeling unwell, generally unwell. He reports...
Sounds like a stock standard case. Okay,
yep. He's got a fever. And he's called today, he's called an ambulance today because he's had a syncopal event and he's fainted at home. You arrive on scene, you've got a gentleman, he's sitting there, he's managed to get himself up off the ground. He doesn't appear particularly injured.
Okay, is he by himself?
He does. So he says to you, I live alone.
Came in as a faint though, right? A syncope?
Correct. That's correct.
Okay. All right. So he's called before or after this alleged faint syncope?
So he had it this morning. He would try to go to the bathroom and he's had this syncopal event and he's managed to get his bearings going again, get himself up, but it just didn't feel right. So he called an ambulance.
Okay. And this is daytime then?
Yep. Daytime.
Cool. All righty. Let's start exploring some of his history and some of his main complaints then.
Awesome. So you have a chat to him. He looks pink, warm and dry. He's able to converse with you. He doesn't have any breathing difficulties. And he says, I've been sick for about a week. He went to his GP. His GP gave him some antibiotics. He doesn't quite know what they were for.
Are these broad spectrum?
Some amoxicillin it was. He also had some steroids as well. And he said he went to the GP because he was having a little bit of difficulty breathing when he walked around the house. He was coughing a lot. He was bringing up a bit of sputum as well. And since then, he started to have a bit of diarrhea as well. And he said he's been on them for a few days. He feels like he's just not getting better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In relation to his vital signs, what do we have?
Yep. So he's got a heart rate of 90. His blood pressure is 140 on 90. Saturations are about 95%. His BSL is 7. His temperature is 38. His ECG seems to be in an atrial flutter. Atrial fibrillation.
Okay.
And a variable rate. Sitting around 90, though. And he's 12
liters. Is he aware that he's got that? Like, is this something he lives with?
So he's on digoxin.
Yeah, good.
He takes some baby aspirin.
Yeah.
And he's only had a medical history. He's got some very mild COPD, but he normally gets around the house fine. And he's got the high blood pressure, the AF, and he had a splenectomy as a child as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I mean, look, it's a fairly involved history, and he's obviously got some complaints here, but he's febrile right now.
Yep.
He said he'd been coughing up sputum. He might have a history of COPD, things like this. You could go a number of different ways with this, hey? But, a fairly common presentation that we go to an ambulance is things like pneumonia, whether it's going to be mild, moderate, or severe. Is they always going to differentiate these things. But what were your thoughts when you got there?
Well, this gentleman, you know, he presents reasonably well. He's got the things that you usually see in this cohort of patients.
There's nothing standing out at me
he doesn't look critically unwell.
When younger paramedics talk about the big job and the exciting job, this certainly isn't one of those.
No.
This is a fairly standard job. Not too much excitement, but at the same time, it is a sick patient. I think a really thorough assessment is what's needed here.
So talking about that, so this guy's he's presenting with these kind of respiratory symptoms, but also some diarrhea. Do you think it's fair to assume that his fever is being caused by something in his lungs, or could it be from a different source?
Oh, look, I mean, it could be respiratory, it could be GI, it could be systemic. It's one of those things. I mean, in out of hospital healthcare, assumptions can certainly lead down the garden path, but at the same time, we've got to take pieces together, and that's information we've got and also experience we've had, and put them together to try and form the most likely differential diagnosis, while we still keep those differentials in the back of our head in case we do need to adjust ourselves. So it's a tricky one. Like you said, a lot of these things he's describing and a lot of these things he's presenting with are not that uncommon for his demographic.
Mm. So how would you examine this guy? Like, we've done a set of vital signs, and I think sometimes we just kind of get caught at the end of our exam being once we've completed our vital signs and ask a few questions. But,
yeah,
you know, there's an opportunity to do a really good physical exam here.
I've caught myself in the past, Nick. The way you examine a patient sometimes is based on your own mood.
Mm.
And I think that traps us sometimes because, you know, I reflect on my career and, you know, people will say all kinds of positive things about what you've done, but that doesn't cause learning. It doesn't cause really good reflection. I think I reflect on a lot of things that I didn't do well and that I can do better. And that's what continues, I guess, to help me evolve as a paramedic. But how I would assess this gentleman, I have to admit, would depend on what time of day it is, what time of shift I've had, or what type of shift I've had. His presentation sometimes even elicits some form of bias in people. So I would like to answer your question and give you a really thorough response. I would like to say, this is what I would do, Nick, because I am top of my game. But if I'm being honest, there's a lot of factors sometimes that impact what I do or don't do. And I don't like to be the one to admit it because that would be the essence of a very average paramedic. But I think at the same time, we've got to admit we're human sometimes. And that's why I think these discussions are so valuable.
Yeah, 100%.
This is a fairly standard case. I'm very unexcited about it. I mean, you said case study. You know, I want like a head trauma. I want like a multi-vehicle RTC. I want a house fire, you know. And you've given me an old dude with a cough and a bit of diarrhea and a temperature.
Yeah, 100%. And I think sometimes we, especially when you're starting to come out of university, you've spent 3 years learning about all these really exciting cases and all these interventions that you can do for people, and then you go out into the real world and you realize that's not how the real world is. The real world is a lot of complex comorbid patients and everything in between, and a lot of these patients don't require really any specific interventions from us. They're probably like 5% of the patients that you go to requiring any intervention, but we can't give these patients any less of our time, focus, energy, or assessment than the ones that we focus so much on in our studies. They all require all of our focus, all of our energy, and the best care that we can provide.
We need to be on our game in every case. You're right. Hey, can we talk about two different things?
Go.
Can we talk about the care, the assessment
yep.
that you think this gentleman required at this point? And then can we talk about the assessment that was actually performed?
Well, right now you've got a gentleman, he's older and he's got some risk factors, all right? So his first risk factor is that he has this ongoing febrile illness, okay? So people get febrile illnesses all the time, and a lot of the time they can be resolved by the GP. They go to the GP, they get some oral antibiotics, they do the course, the antibiotics work, they get better. Awesome. So the fact that this person's gone to a GP, they've had an assessment, they've been prescribed treatment, they've engaged in that care and then haven't been able to resolve their symptoms. If anything, they're getting worse, that's a bit of a red flag for me. All right, I'll get out my little bag of red flags and I'll put the first one up. All right. The second red flag for this gentleman is the fact that he's had a syncopal event. Okay, you can have syncopes in association with illness for a number of different causes. Sometimes it's because you have you're hypovolemic. Sometimes you can be caused by other forms of just shock. Okay, where you're not getting blood flow back to the heart or the brain. Or it's just part of the illness. Like for me, when I get tonsillitis, for some reason I get syncope with it. I don't know why, it just happens. But the fact that he's had a syncopal event means that if there's something in his body driving the syncope, and we don't resolve that stressor, there's a good chance, I would say, that he's at risk of having another syncope. And what happens when older people fall? They have brittle bones. They break things, okay? So he got off a bit scot-free this time. He's managed to get up and be relatively uninjured. Let's say he has another syncope. It could fall over, break his hip, and end up in hospital for 6 months, right? The third, I'll bring out even bigger red flag, the biggest one I have for this guy, is the fact that he lives alone, okay? So let's say he stayed here, he has another syncope, he breaks his hip, he can't call an ambulance because he can't get to the phone and no one can come and find him. And then he sits on the ground, gets sicker and sicker and sicker, all right? So there's big red flags. What about the splenectomy? Is that a red flag for you?
Well, you said that he was, 70-something?
Yep.
And I mean, during the initial discussion, he'd said that he'd had this in during his childhood.
Correct.
Look, a lot of people are going to let this one breeze over their head. It was so long ago.
Mm. So your spleen has a significant role in your immune response, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have a spleen, you can't mount the same immune response that a normal person can have. So in the presence of infection, your ability to combat that is far less than the average person who has a spleen. So with all those red flags out there, do you think this guy probably warrants something more than just go back to your GP?
Well, he's already been to the GP.
He has.
And what the GP has essentially prescribed has not assisted this gentleman. And sending him back to the same place is probably not going to be the best case for this patient. So, no, I would say sending him back to the GP at this point is probably not the advice this patient needs. And like you appropriately pointed out, he lives by himself too, so I mean, if we're going to refer him back to his GP, that basically that creates a situation where he is going to be left in the care of who?
No one.
Well, in this case, no one. So, no, I think he needs a good thorough assessment. But as paramedic clinicians or paramedicine officers, what does this gentleman need apart from transport at the moment?
He needs a more thorough assessment, right?
Assessment's not necessarily going to make people better, though. So you are right. We need to assess people before we're actually able to impact. With everything that you've told me, what does this patient actually need from your perspective?
Well, he needs the assessment, but he needs further treatment or more invasive treatment, right?
More invasive treatment.
Oral antibiotics may not help. He might need some intravenous antibiotics or some other medication.
So this is something that you're saying we can't do on the street? We can't do in his lounge room?
No.
Okay. While we're sitting in his lounge room, though, prioritise for me how you're going to approach this this patient.
So I think information gathering is incredibly important because it allows you to have an overall picture of everything that's going on. So that information can come from a number of sources. It's not just your vital signs. It's not just your SAMPLE information. That's part of it, but it's also part of looking at like doing a physical examination, so examining the patient. It's a great piece of advice I got years ago. Is more is missed by not looking than by not finding. If we don't listen to the patient's chest, if we don't listen to the heart sounds, if we don't have a feel of the abdomen, if we don't talk about urine output and their bowel motions, if we don't look for sources of infection in their any like new wounds, we're not going to find it. So we've got to look for it to be able to find it. Your physical exam will be able to give you some information, probably a little bit more information than you had by simply just asking some questions and doing some vital signs. But it's not going to give you the full clinical picture, okay? If you could get a full clinical picture, then we wouldn't need ultrasound, CT scanners, and blood tests, right? So when to get a full clinical picture to be able to, you know, absolve this patient of having any significant conditions that can't be treated by a GP, then I need to go to a place that can provide that level of assessment, okay? The thing you can do that hospitals cannot do as paramedics is you can review this patient's social health, right? And what I mean by that is you're in their home, right? It's very rare that a hospital clinician, unless they do home or outreach kind of stuff, can truly appreciate it how the patient is caring for themselves in their own house. So while you're there, it's important to appreciate and dig a little about how the patient's doing well, especially when they're a bit older and there may be a need for them to get some assistance. Because as you get older, it's harder to do the things that we always do, the things we take for granted, you know, eating, cleaning, looking after yourself. So you can have a look around the house. Is it neat? Is it tidy? Are there any trip hazards? Are they having multiple falls? Is there food in the fridge? Is the toilet clean? All those kinds of things you can observe. And if you start to see things that you think might mean that the patient might be having some challenges doing those normal daily duties at home, you can provide that information to the hospital so they can use that and try and create some support for that patient.
So this is even before you're conducting a physical exam, which, I mean, from what you're describing too, I mean, we're not saying don't do the physical exam, but, I mean, a lot of the physical examinations and more in-depth examinations can occur in the hospital. The key piece they're going to be missing, and this is the place that he needs to go, is that social history. We get a front seat view of how this person is actually coping, essentially.
100%. So we've done all that information. So we've taken a patient who essentially at the start, and the information that we may have been provided on the way to this job was a gentleman who's fallen over, who's got a fever, who's been to his GP, okay? So, and that's where we've started. And you could approach that case or that information with, oh, they're fine, they need to go back to their GP, they'll be right. And we, with all this new information, we can appreciate this patient probably needs to have their care escalated. And it's that same old premise of if you've done something and it hasn't produced the outcome that you want, there's no point in repeating that same thing because you're going to get the same outcome. And this same principle can be applied to patient care. So how do we convey that to the patient? Do we say, hey, buddy, done some assessments, looked at your vital signs, got a bit of a fever, but your blood pressure's okay, your heart rate's okay, everything else looks fine. What would you like to do? Or do we do something different?
It does depend on the patient in terms of what they're going to describe, but I think we're lacking some key pieces of advice there for that person to make an informed decision as well.
Yeah. This is going to sound a little contentious, but this is a comment I'm going to make to try and improve how we practice at paramedics.
Okay.
I think we've slipped into this culture of asking the patient how they would like to proceed with their care. And part of that's come from trying to do the best thing for the patient and that shared decision model that gets discussed around different circles. The problem with this is that if we say to the patient, all your numbers are fine, what do you want to do? We shift the responsibility of the decision-making onto the patient and we haven't truly informed them of our advice based on the assessments that we've made, right? So essentially, instead of us making a decision or a recommendation of care to the patient, the onus of the decision-making is on the patient. All right. So how can they make an informed decision if we haven't provided a recommendation of care?
This is an interesting discussion. And it certainly it's moved away from the clinical aspects of this case, which I think is brilliant because so much of what we do is not clinical. So there's so many non-clinical parts of what we do. You're talking about professional responsibility here. It is that unexciting, uninspiring case. That a lot of people often don't put a lot of energy into. And I think your observations there, your statements about almost shirking responsibility back on the patient sometimes, it does occur. It does occur. It does occur in our practice. And it is something that we can improve on because essentially we're the professional service that have been asked to come down and give an opinion on something to assist people. It's an avenue that I didn't think we were going to discuss, and this is why I love these conversations, Nick, because I think this is so valuable. If I reflect on my own practice too, I think I've done this.
Oh, I've done it 100 times.
And it's not a proud statement to make, but again, if we can't discuss where we can improve and we can't own our mistakes, then we're never going to actually develop that next stage, that next paramedic to be, providing better care. If we can go back to the clinical aspects of it really quickly, I mean, there's some vital signs that are slightly skewed. We'd obviously conduct an assessment of their abdomen. We'd conduct an assessment of their respiratory system. We would use that information to inform the person, correct?
Correct.
That is if they were done and done appropriately. If we're using these to inform the patient, would that still be defined as placing the responsibility back on the patient then if we then gave them the option or are you saying that we should be giving a recommendation here?
I think we need to be giving a recommendation of care. In almost all instances, people call, you go to your doctor, you go to your mechanic, you call paramedic because you want their professional opinion.
Is this about giving an opinion or is this about giving options?
Maybe opinion's the wrong word. I would say an advice. They have a problem and they're looking to you to provide a solution to that problem.
Professional opinions kind of advice.
I'd call that, yeah. So, and I think we have a responsibility to our patients to be able to provide that. And that's not to say that we necessarily always need to have the answers. And a lot of the time we don't have the answers for these patients, but sometimes that can be part of our advice. Is that, so if, say for this gentleman, it might be along the lines of, you know, I can't tell you why you've had your syncopal episode. I can't tell you why your infection isn't getting better, but my advice would be that you would need to go to hospital to have some further examinations done and to get some different forms of treatment. They're going to help you get on top of this more quickly. Now, it's up to them whether or not they accept that advice, right? And that's part of that joint decision-making. But we still need to provide that recommendation of care to the patient. And this is for all patients. And sometimes it could be, I'm not sure. I can't give you an answer. But I can still give you advice on how to move forward from here. It might be, I can't give you an answer, so we should go to hospital. It might be, I can't give you an answer, but you're low risk. Let's get you into a GP or a virtual emergency department or refer you to a primary healthcare provider in the community, and that's a reasonable decision. Or it might be, I can't tell you what's going on, but you're incredibly low risk for significant illness, so continue to care for yourself at home and look out for X, Y, and Z.
Nick, this has been an awesome discussion, and I think it's thought provoking in so many different aspects of what we do. We're getting to the end of our time slot because you and I promised people that we would never ramble on for more than about 25 minutes, 20 minutes if we're being good. But what would be the single biggest take home for you then from this case, this 70-something-year-old gentleman who lives alone?
So for me, for this guy, and I've made these, this is a mistake I've made in my career a few times. And these podcasts are about our own reflections and things we've done in the past and how we've learned from them and how we can share those learnings with our audience. So for me, the biggest thing is changing something. You know, if you've had a patient that's been to a GP, they've had some treatment, they've had some assessment, they're not getting better, and they've got some risk factors for severe illness, like their age, not having a spleen, they're in the presence of some fainting or some syncope at home. We need to change something, and changing something to escalating their care and assessment to a hospital can be what the patient needs. Now, if they go to hospital and they do all these assessments and they don't find anything, awesome, great outcome, fantastic. But we'd hate to leave that patient at home and send them back to the GP and they're septic and they get really sick, and then when they don't get to a hospital for 3 or 4 days and then end up in intensive care or worse. So it's really important that if something doesn't work, you got to change something to expect a different outcome. What's the take home for you, Tony?
Look, it's that good thorough assessment. It's the same take home that comes for me for a lot of these cases, where you reflect on how you approach the case and you reflect on your own situation, and it's how you approach the case is also how you treat the patient as a human. And I think, you know, these discussions are so important to really reflect on how we approach these. And for me, it is just that clinical approach, that human approach, that what is this patient's complaints? What are the findings I have? What have they done in the past? And what does this patient actually need? And then how I can provide. It's just meshing those together. And I mean, that's essentially what we are supposed to do as part of our role anyway.
Awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, check out our website. It's the shiftextension.org.
It's been a while.
Check out our website. Check out our magazine, as well as all of our podcast. And if you have any questions, please write to us. You can email us through the website or come see us in person. But until next time, see you later.